We're back on Canucks Central. It's Dan Riccio and Satyar Shah. This hour of Canucks Central brought to you by your Lower Mainland Boston Pizza. Every Vancouver hockey game gets $5 pints of Molson Canadian or Coors Light plus weekly prize giveaways all season long at your local Lower Mainland Boston Pizza. Let's bring in our next guest, the goalie guru, In Goal Magazine and NHL.com's Kevin Woodley. He is a presentation of White Rock Hyundai. What's happening, Woodley?
Well, it's taken me till just now to scrape myself out of the fetal position after watching that game last night as a goaltender. I needed to take the morning, guys. That was a little rough. That was a little rough for the goaltending fraternity.
So the Canucks solved Casey DeSmith, the best goalie in the National Hockey League? Or one of them?
The best adjusted save percentage in the National Hockey League, or one of the top three going in. And there's a trend there that we can get to in a minute in terms of, especially since the Four Nations, who's been the best. And he was on an absolute heater until last night. But I thought the guys in the broadcast, Shorty and Tomlinson, did a nice job of sort of identifying one of his defining traits in Dallas, and that's the aggression that he's playing with. And he is quick. He's so fast. He does sort of manage to pull it off. But, you know, that's the one thing as you get in discussions about some of these, you know, 1Bs that are on heaters and the possibility of seeing them in the playoffs. You know, anybody that plays to an extreme, it's easier to target those extremes when you get into a postseason. And so, you know, for a guy like Casey, I mean, you would just start passing around him, right? So, hey, it was an interesting game last night from a lot of different aspects, mostly just how wild it was, how porous the penalty killing was, how neither team seemed to give a crap about defending the slot, especially late, and the goalies were the victims. So there we go. It's can't always be a night for the goalie union, boys, and I can accept that.
Yeah, sometimes those things do happen. Exciting. And it was just an insane hockey game, right? And I think all those types of things had to happen for this historic event to occur, for a team to come back from 3 goals down with a minute left. I mean, it doesn't just happen in a normal environment, right?
No. I mean, no, absolutely not. It wouldn't be historic if it did, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you know, poor one out for the poor writers on deadline. Like, I just felt for my NHL.com counterpart last night. That was, as much as the goaltenders were in the fetal position, so were those who have to file at the buzzer.
IMAX said he had the right version, too, of his story when the game flipped.
Listen, IMAX is freaking brilliant. Makes me sick what he does on deadline. Ever since my first week on the job, when he managed to both work in and correctly spell Snuffleupagus into a lead before we had a chance to search things on the internet and double check them. That's how old we are. But world's biggest violins playing for IMAX, who does not have to file at the buzzer, files his story after he comes back down. Some of us have to file a story before we go to the room and then come back up and write it through. And those are the ones you should have the most sympathy for. World's biggest violin playing for me right now. I was having flashbacks to the Boudreaux era, right? It was just wild. And so there are tons of positives you can take out about no quit and determination. And there's probably going to come a time in this team's future with some of the same players on it where they can go to that well and, you know, look back at that when the, you know, win one for the Gipper type speech when you're down in the third period or down in the final minute, and maybe that pays off. But you also got to look at why they were in that spot and be realistic. As you said, if it's never happened in the National Hockey League before, for all those positives we look to, it's certainly not something you can count on moving forward.
No, it was just chaos, you know.
It was honestly like it was the craziest thing ever.
It was a Dallas team that thought they were home and cooled out, and then the Canucks were just like, maybe we're not done yet.
Half the building left. It was funny. Like we had
definition of foot off the gas.
We had Canucks fans from Dallas calling after the game, and like there was this kid who called in Ray and was taunting the fans after they were leaving. He's like, "You guys left the game. Well, you guys lost."
They took their foot off the gas.
It was nuts. It was nuts. Probably doesn't change anything, but hey, in a season with a lot of downs, it was sure fun to watch.
Yeah, made NHL history. And, you know, some of the things that they did in that final minute, I know Dallas kind of got away from what their game was, but it was interesting hearing Rick Tocchet after the game say his son texted him and said, that looked like last year's team. And it kind of did, you know, the amount of work they put in on the forecheck and winning pucks down low and going low to high into the slot and finding guys for open opportunities. Like that's the kind of thing we just haven't seen the Canucks do enough of this year.
Well, I was going to say, but it's not the first time we've seen it this year at 6-on-5.
Yeah.
Like how many times in the last couple of weeks have they pulled rabbits out of their hat with an extra attacker when the desperation kicks in? And so the question becomes, can you find any of that when you don't have an extra guy on the ice? Can you, I mean, I'll be honest, like earlier this season, there were times, there were nights where, you know, work ethic and determination were called into question by the coaching staff as well, right? Would you be in this spot if you had found more of that type of determination earlier in the season and throughout 60 minutes as opposed to the final minute, when you've got your goalie out and you're just, everything is just pushed forward? Obviously there's a balance. You can't just, you know, everybody crash the net. You have to have some defensive responsibility. And certainly we've seen them start to give up more off the rush of late as guys sort of at times get caught. I don't know if it's a full diving in. Sometimes it was, I think one of Mancini in the last home game where we're kind of late to do it and got caught. You know, but that balance between everything pushing forward and not getting caught, but also not sitting back too much. So, hey, at least you see it's there. We've seen it's there. It's in them. They haven't given up. Those things are all positives. But the question becomes next year, how much of that, and obviously three goals in the final minute with two of them with the goalie pulled, isn't, but how much of what we're seeing and what parts of it are repeatable with this personnel, mm-hmm. with a reset next year?
Yeah, it's going to be really, really interesting to look at. And, you know, before we dig into some of the things Quinn Hughes had to say, you mentioned the trend for goalies and Thatcher Demko and looking at where his game is at. You mentioned the environment last night being difficult to really judge the goalies on, but where his game's been at and also what we're kind of learning about what happened post Four Nations and how the Canucks may handle their goalies next season.
Well, I mean, the truth is, I mean, Lankinen's last start was great, but he's trending in the wrong direction since Four Nations. Demko was great coming back out of the gate, but his last three haven't been as good. And I would chalk last night up to, you know, high danger chances on the power. The only one was the one where he got caught looking the wrong way with Ben behind the net. That's a same side play. It's the only one that sort of gets classified as low danger. Everything else is high danger that he gives up. So it's one of those nights where, you know, penalty kill's not going and not being effective, and you sort of got to tip your cap. But at the end of the day, statistically, the last three have been trending in the wrong way. There's been some open looks that have gone in uncharacteristically, beat clean on a few. And, you know, now, you know, since Four Nations as a total, he's on the wrong side of expected, right? A full percentage below Lankinen, a full 2% below Artur Seelov's 2.3%. So, I mean, that's 34th, 50th, and 54th out of 67 goalies that have seen at least 50 shots since the Four Nations. Not where you want to be, not where this team needs to be moving forward. I do, you know, despite that, have a lot of faith that both of these guys are capable, obviously, of better. We've seen it from both of them. And that maybe if you can find the right blend of starts, you're more likely to get it. And that's where the trend since the Four Nations at the other end of that, you know, performance spectrum is really interesting to note. Out of the top 10, there's been a few guys that have dropped out of this of late, but out of the top 10 goalies in adjusted save percentage since the Four Nations break, the top seven are backups or guys who missed time with significant injury. Guys like Anton Forsberg, James Reimer, Scott Wedgwood, Casey DeSmith, even after last night, is six. That's how much of a heater he was on going into it to escape last night and still be in that mix. Freddie Anderson, who didn't play a lot early, seventh. Akira Schmid getting a taste late in the season, handful of games, he's first. Grubauer, after getting bounced to the American Hockey League, finally gets a chance to come up and play on a semi-regular basis after really struggling in a pure backup role earlier this season. And I think there's a lesson there. It'll be interesting to see if teams can figure this out, because for him, sort of getting blindsided with Joey's the number one, I think he found out about it when the media asked him, and then just not really settling into a backup role. Ever since he's been back from the American League and playing on an every second game basis until illness last night, one of the better goalies in the NHL. And so none of these guys have played a lot. And does that mean you're going to trust any of them in the playoffs? You're going to go to any of them in the playoffs? I'd make an argument to Smith, you know, given how good he's been, probably deserves some games in the playoffs, but not to start. Freddie Anderson, you know, again, you can play him in the postseason, but don't, like they did last year. He came back, did this last year, barely played all season, played great down the stretch, and then they rolled him out there every second night and he wore down within the first round. Like, made no sense. So we've got to learn some lessons here about workload. Not until you get to eighth, you see Darcy Kemper, ninth, Andre Vasilevsky, 10th, Dustin Wolf, 11th, Philip Gustafson. But even beyond that, there's a Jonas Johansson in there, right? There's a Dan Vladar in the top 20. So guys that aren't playing a lot are having success late in the season, and that can't be a coincidence. Like, we're now talking about like well over a month of sample size. And I don't think that can be completely a coincidence. There has to be something to this. If all the guys that are playing the best are the guys that haven't played the most. And so with next season, having the Olympics as part of it, Lankinen and possibly even Demko being a part of that Olympics and requiring travel, I think it's going to be even more important that workloads are managed. And so with both guys in tow, they're in a position to do it the right way. But I do think there are some lessons to be learned from the way this is sort of playing out down the stretch here. And what's going to be really fascinating is, you know, what teams, and there's a handful I can think of that I would suggest, you know, don't just go with one guy. You know, don't just go with a clear-cut starter start to finish in the playoffs. When you see that your backup can give you this level of quality once a week.
Yeah, I imagine the Leafs with Stolarz and Wall, as we're watching on Sportsnet right now, against the Lightning, up 2-0. That's probably one where you're not going the traditional, we're going with one guy in the playoffs, as much as our friendly radio hosts in Toronto try to make that a thing. It's not really, it doesn't really make a ton of sense in a lot of situations.
It makes it easier for the friendly radio host to make it a thing when the head coach does. Like Craig Berube said, he wants one guy.
Yeah.
And he's got two guys, neither of whom have played a full season. Like, this is both the most games they've played, even with Stolarz missing all the time with a knee injury. What about that says, boy, we better ride one guy? And the problem with going back and forth for large chunks of the season and then riding one is by the time you start to see the diminishing returns, you think, okay, maybe we better give the other guy a shot, kind of like Boston did the first year coming off of the partnership. The other guy's, instead of being every second game like he has been all season, the other guy's been sitting for a week or 10 days, and now he's in a high-pressure situation. So they're one, certainly. You know, I know this is a little tougher to say coming off of last night, but like the reality is Casey DeSmith, we saw what happened here in Vancouver, right? Great in the backup role, make him the starter, and if you need him for a stretch of time, it started to fall off a little bit. But in the backup role, he delivered high-quality starts, and he has this season. Jake Ottinger has been a league-average goaltender all season. Mm-hmm. He's been below since the Four Nations. So if you're not getting more out of him, he's had one of the and you can't see it in the numbers because he's had one of the most, like 9-10 expected save percentage, one of the highest in the entire league since the Four Nations, and one of the top four highest overall at over 900 for the season. So the numbers are going to look fine, but his performance relative to it hasn't been at the same level. And so if you start to see signs of fatigue on top of that, I don't think you can hesitate to go to a DeSmith. Freddie Anderson and Pyotr Kochetkov, like Kochetkov's fallen off a cliff for the last month. So does that mean, and this is where it gets tough. This is where I don't have all the answers here. Freddie needs to play, but you can't play him too much. But by bringing him back and sort of casting doubt in Piotr's mind about who's number one, and Piotr was trending into the top 10 at that point until Anderson came back, some guys need to know they're the number one. I've heard that about Darcy Kemper in LA after Washington, when Lindgren started to eat in the starts, he fell off. Like, some guys need to know that they're the guy. Other guys need to be pushed. And so that becomes part of this conversation. I just think, given how much some of the high workload guys have struggled as the season's gone on, if you've got a backup you can trust, then whether it's three out of every four you think about making it, you know, switching it up, you have to at least consider it. I don't think anyone will. I think I'm probably just screaming into the void here, but I think there's a number of teams that should.
Yeah, and I think it really highlights the decision the Canucks might have this summer. I know a lot of our listeners will just say, hey, trade Demko, get the asset, open up the cap space, and allocate that money and that asset to the forward group. And it's like, yeah, that sounds all simple. But then,
let's be honest.
Who are you playing next to Kevin Lankinen next year then?
And you're selling at a low.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you're not selling at a high there. That said, like, A lot of guys have settled in. A lot of guys re-signed with their team. The goalie musical chairs, like the top of the UFA pool this summer is Freddie Anderson and Jake Allen.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe that creates a bit more of a buyer's market, but I would imagine it would be a buyer beware market just because of the injury history. And I think the combination is if they plan to win next year and they're going to need two, along with, if he plays well, if nothing else, you've increased his value for a potential trade unless you decide to re-up him. And, you know, again, I don't know what that math looks like. But I think getting him playing healthy and playing well for a stretch of time is probably better than trading him coming off a season that's been as trying and difficult in so many different respects as this one.
Yeah, and, you know, it was interesting reading Quinn Hughes' quotes to Ian McIntyre on his piece today, and he mentioned he feels like with the goalies, they have the best tandem in the league, the best duo in the league, and talked very glowingly also about the head coach. We know the head coach's contract situation is what it is, but when you see Quinn be so effusive in his praise and his desire to bring the coach back, is it almost just not like, should money not get in the way of the Canucks doing what it takes here to bring the coach back for the player they want to keep here long term?
I mean, probably not, but it's been a factor in other decisions when it comes to coaching. I don't think necessarily at the highest level, but certainly with assistance and things like that over the years, to some degree. And I actually gotta be careful there, because I think in large part, there's been corners cut with this franchise in a lot of different aspects, but not usually at the high end, not when it comes to salary cap and player personnel, and not usually when it comes to management and coaching staff. We've seen it at the minor league level at times, taking cheaper routes. It sounds like finance was a part of some of those decisions in the past year, but hard to argue with the way those decisions have panned out this year, with the way things are going in Abbotsford, both from a development perspective and a success on ice perspective. But are we sure it's just finances that?
No, and that's the thing.
I mean, to me, that's for sure. You know, I'm not sure this is just a financial decision. This may be more about a direction decision from the coaching or the coach's standpoint. And frankly, maybe as much when it comes to that direction, maybe as much about decisions already made from a personnel standpoint. So we'll have to wait and see. I mean, I was the first one to ask about it last summer, and I got told this was nothing because there. And after I asked about it on a conference call, they quickly made it clear that they had an option, that this wasn't a concern. But here we are, less than a year later. Let's see where this goes, because I've heard different things about that desire to stay, and yet none of it matters until we sort of get down to brass tacks and a decision needing to be made.
Last thing before we let you go, Alex Ovechkin scores .895 on the weekend, beats Ilya Sorokin, first time he scored against him. Already on a couple of occasions through the week, we've heard people refer to goalies in the way that they talk about Ovechkin's shot and how it's different from any other shot in NHL history. Have you spoken to goalies about Ovechkin's shot and what makes it different from the way other people shoot the puck?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a story up at ingoalmag.com. I'm going to be honest, I think we may have been the first ones. I think it was around goal 500, and I had never seen this story before. I was asked to write it from a goalie perspective, and I had a good relationship with Braden at the time, and we talked about it. And as far as I know, that was sort of the first time it became really sort of widespread public knowledge that it curves, that Ovi has a curveball, that it knuckles and it dives and it swings away from you, that it is not just straight heat. And so when Braden told me, I didn't believe it. So I had to start asking around, and Ryan Miller confirmed it. A handful of goalies confirmed it, like, absolutely. And it's a combination of two things. One, it's the banana hook he's got on that thing, but then also it's, and he doesn't use it all the time, But when he has, he used to have that little at the, like, it's got a wicked curve, but then at the end, it's like a little hook, like a little notch. Mm-hmm. And so where he catches that puck on a one-timer changes the way it comes off the blade in a way that no goalie can read. Like, Devin Dubnyk told me it can come off four different ways depending on where it leaves the blade. And as a goaltender, you're just trying to read one-timer and trying to read puck. But when it's coming with that much velocity, and especially when you can throw it 100 miles an hour, I think he won the skills competition at 101 in 2018. But also, if he catches it off the toe or it releases off the toe, it turns over and knuckles at like 75, you're expecting the 100-mile-an-hour heater, and he delivers the 75-mile-an-hour knuckleball, and now you're like a battery swung twice by the time it gets to the plate. You've screwed yourself into the ground. Like, it's really tough. The other thing he doesn't do is he doesn't miss the net very often with it. So he forces goalies to make a save. And because of the spin, when goalies talk about a heavy shot, that's spin. When it hits you, it feels harder because of the spin on it. It kind of sticks to your gear and sort of, it's like a drill. It sort of gets in there a little bit. That's why you see the black marks all over goalies' equipment. That's pucks that hit them with a lot of spin. That's a heavy shot. Those are the ones, if they hit you in the face, you can end up like me missing a tooth, or it glances off your mask and it smells like you're in the parking lot in the 70s and your buddy's Camaro and they're doing burnouts. It's just like, it's like you're literally at a drag race and smelling the rubber, like it's under your nose. It's the smell of burning rubber. And Ovi, the spin he puts on it is unbelievable. And that spin with the puck moving right to left, it finds more seams, finds more holes. It's likely to sort of make its way through you. And so you're moving to your right. And if he hits it on your glove side, guys told me they felt it was going wide and it would sort of almost curve around the glove outside, kind of like a left-handed batter, and that curveball's coming at you, so you bail. Well, this is actually going around them and catching the backside of the plate, like a left-handed hitter, I guess, right, against a right-handed curveball. You know, it's coming around and catching the outside of the plate. And the ones that beat you on the blocker side, you feel like it's coming right at you, and it dives down and away, either underneath your arm or low blocker side. So I've talked to more than a dozen guys about this. Nobody else... It was Reimer that said it's the most unique shot in the NHL. Nobody else has anything like it. And because of that, there's just no way to prepare for it. Holtby told me that his only preparation was to finally come to an understanding with Ovi in practice that he couldn't give it to Gas all the time because he was going to kill him.
Unbelievable stuff. And that's why he's the greatest goal scorer in NHL history. Woodley, always appreciate the insights. Thanks so much for this today.
Thanks, guys.
Ah, there
we go
is.
Back to the fetal position now. Between Ovechkin and 11 goals last night.
Yeah. Thanks, Woodley. There he is. Kevin Woodley on Sports at 650, brought to you by White Rock Hyundai. Visit the showroom on King George in White Rock or whiterockhyundai.com. So we heard it. Brad Richardson mentioned it last night that he talked to some of his goalies and what made the shot so different. There is the goalie perspective, or as close as you can get to the goalie perspective of Ovechkin's shot.
Yeah, and we've heard a lot about that too the last few days. I mean, we spoke to Brad Richardson about it. We spoke to Joe Beninati, who's called every single Ovechkin goal, 1 through 895.
Yes.
So, you know, and they all mention when you watch Ovechkin closely, like, he shoots the puck unlike anybody else. Like, it rolls on you. And Richardson was quoting, well, he was referencing what Jonathan Quick was saying about him. And it's like, it's almost like a knuckleball being shot at you. And it's like a knuckleball coming at like 100 miles an hour.
It's not something that should happen with a cylinder, you know? Like, I remember, so we used to play intramural ball hockey in high school. And one of the teachers we had, one of the gym teachers, Lucius Lesio, the father of Lucas Lesio, who was a Montreal Canadiens draft pick, it was a ball hockey Hall of Famer. And anytime you were beating the teachers, because the teachers had their own team, anytime you were beating the teachers,
that was a big deal.
Lucius Lesio would just like turn it up a notch. He'd have the salad flowing through the air. And then he'd come down. He's like this huge, burly man. And he'd just come down and he'd like flick his wrist with this snapshot. And this orange ball would knuckle at you. And you're like, whoa, this is crazy. What is it doing? It's like moving in so many different directions. If you were like, our goalie would be like, I don't know what to do. This is like this. It's like a knuckleball. It's like Tim Wakefield's out there. It's so... To hear that about Ovechkin on the ice, because nobody really does that with a cylindrical thing. It happens with a ball. It's pretty fascinating. Yeah. Anyways.
It's great stuff.
That's my story about Luscious Lesio. You can find a page about him online if you really want to. Right, Ontario Ball Hockey Hall of Famer. Dan Riccio, Satyar Shah.
Luscious.
It is Canucks Central on Sportsnet 650.
Discussing the biggest stories that matter to Vancouver sports fans. Halford and Brough in the morning. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back on Canucks Central. It's Stan Riccio and Satyar Shah here in the Kintec studio. This hour of Canucks Central is brought to you by BC Liquor. Until April 26th, get $5 off Donna Paula Malbec or $3 off Neutral Vodka Soda Lime 12 packs. Visit your nearest BC Liquor location today. Enjoy responsibly. So, yes, you can't fully turn your attention to the off season just yet for the Vancouver Canucks after the incredible comeback of last night, but the future is still very much on the mind, and Tom Volander is a big part of that. Mm-hmm. He is headed to the Frozen Four this weekend with Boston University, his second trip there in as many years with the Terriers, and it's been a good year for Tom Volander.
It really has. And when you talk to people that have been watching him closely, they note how some of the areas where, you know, maybe harsh to say he struggled at, but things need to improve on, he has improved on. And he's a guy that we understand takes guidance very well,
mm-hmm.
is a student who wants to get better and works at his game.
Coachable.
Yes, very coachable. So I'm not surprised he's made some improvements in his game, and he remains a very exciting player long term.
You saw it at the World Juniors, and you've seen it with Boston. You wouldn't notice it just by looking at his statistics for the year, but certainly in his usage and the way that he has improved as a defender, it's evident how Tom Volander continues to come along and could start his pro career very soon, but not before the Frozen Four is upon us for Tom Volander. And he joins us now here on Canucks Central. Thanks for doing this, Tom. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
We're doing pretty well. So how's the run been so far? Your second time around getting to the Frozen Four.
Yeah, no, it's exciting stuff. Like you said, been here before, but you know, it's nice to get up on the big stage. You know, it's now or never. This is the game we lost last year, so obviously we're trying to dial in here and make sure we can go all the way.
How do you navigate being motivated, but at the same time not getting overly psyched up and trying to redeem yourself from last year?
I think there's like, I think it almost balances like itself a little bit, because I think there's definitely, you know, the excitement from playing these big games and, you know, like, you know, playing better than last year and actually making it all the way. But at the same time, you know, there's a bit of pressure. You know, there's a lot of guys that are playing this for like the last time. So I think that, you know, combined with the pressure and, you know, just kind of pulling it down, because like really at the end of the day, like looking from an outside perspective, it's like looks a lot different than it does like from our locker room. Because for us, it's the same group, you know, that's been playing the same 40 games this season, and really we're just trying to do the exact same thing that we've done all year.
How is that process like, building as a group, as a team? You know, you've done it with Sweden at the World Juniors, and here with Boston, you as we mentioned, you went to the Frozen Four last year. Like, what is that process trying to grow as a team and really find the best version of yourselves?
I think, you know, obviously there's going to be trial and error. And I think you have that, kind of that opportunity in the beginning of the season and in the mid part of the season. But, you know, the closer you get to the end, and I'd say especially here, in the NCAA, where you can't really have an off day. So I feel like you get into a spot where towards the end of the season, you really have to find like a rhythm as a team. And you know, being able to execute every game, and you're kind of fighting that rhythm where even if like everyone doesn't have like their best day, we're still comfortable enough in our system to where we can, you know, always kind of play our hockey.
And I think that's something we've been able to do, now looking towards the end. But I also think that our team as a whole, I feel like we do perform better in these kind of tough games, you know, these bigger games. And I think that's what kind of has been our best attributes, that I feel like when the spotlight's on, I feel like we have a whole lot of guys that perform better.
What's the journey been like for you in college? Has it been everything you had hoped for when you joined the U?
Yeah, I think so. I think, obviously, I think it's been like great opportunities to take your game to the next level. I think the game is obviously on another level from the junior game in, back in Sweden. So, I've also felt like I've had a lot of fun, you're really close with the guys on the team, and I feel like every day here's a gift. It's been a blast.
Yeah, I imagine the college experience is pretty cool to have, as well as, continuing to grow your potentially professional career. And one of the differences is, there's not quite as many games, and I guess that gives you a lot more time to build off the ice as well, and maybe work on skill components of your game, rather than, hey, I'm playing a game every other night like you might in major junior up here in Canada or whatever it might be.
Yeah. No, I think so. I think there's positive and negatives to both of them.
Right.
I think obviously you can you have a bit more time to get in the gym and getting those skills practices on your own. I'm just getting on the sheet a bit more. But at the same time, kind of the way we play, at the World Juniors, I'd say that's a lot closer to a professional schedule, where we play seven games in 14 days, something like that. And I think there's positives to that, too. I feel like it's a lot easier to get into a good game rhythm, where you just, feel, more comfortable in the games. That's where on college hockey, you'll have, a six-day six-day break from playing. So I think there's positive and negative to both of them, but I think both of them is kind of good to have.
When you look at your game and how this year, based on everybody that watches your game, they see your puck skills have improved, even offensively it's improved. How much does that practice time help you to really hone in on your skills, especially when you have a strong system and support staff like you do have at BU?
I think you really get to work on your individual skills in different situations. I feel like obviously since you don't have as many games, you can practice a bit harder, but I feel like you can also find more time to kind of just get on the sheet by yourself, or stay out a little bit extra and just kind of work through those moments and situations in games that you don't really feel like you have too much confidence in. And I think that's one of the best things with college, is you kind of get that opportunity to really just get on the sheet and spend many hours practicing.
How do you feel your game has matured and improved?
I think I've been able to be better in most areas of the game. I think the more I play, the more experience I get against better players, the better I get without the puck. But I feel like, through trial and error, I think I've been able to hone my skills with the puck as well, seeing kind of what works, what doesn't work. And as I said, that time when we don't play games, kind of work on those parts that doesn't really fit. So I think generally, I think I've been taking good jumps this season, and also working on getting a bit of a more consistent game, because I think that's very, very important if you want to be a part of a winning team, to be able to play, a consistent game.
And, I always hear about how big confidence is, and you always showed that you had a lot of confidence when you were drafted. I remember talking to you after being drafted, and, you've always had the humble aspect, but also confident in moving forward. How much has that confidence grown over the course of this year?
Well, I think you obviously, the more you play, the more experience you have, that obviously feeds into you having more confidence in different situations. Generally, I feel like the more you get to experience stuff on the ice, it really helps. So I feel like just playing games, and like I said before, seeing what works, what doesn't work. It's what kind of gives you that confidence to play, you know, and just kind of let loose. But yeah.
And you're also playing with a couple of other top-end NHL prospects. You know, Cole Yzerman was a 20th overall pick in the draft, and we see the numbers Cole Hudson's putting up right now. Does that help, or you know, how cool is that to come along with some other guys that are destined for the NHL?
I mean, I think we're all kind of here for a similar reason. I think we all kind of have our minds in the similar direction. I think there's a lot of talent on our team. I think there's a lot of talented guys, and I think that's a lot of fun, you know, having that kind of group play together like on this level. But something that I also find very nice is that I feel like we all kind of have our minds in the same space where we try to focus on, you know, the next day, next game here.
Mm-hmm.
And not try to get too far ahead, which I think just elevates the experience.
Well, and it's one of those things, too, that as much as you're a team, a lot of these guys are playing for futures in hockey, too, right? I mean, you've been drafted. Other guys are trying to, you know, force their way into the NHL. I mean, one of your teammates, Aiden Celebrini, drafted a bit later, so there's a lot of pressure on him to get better and improve. And how do you kind of navigate that as a team where it's like you have these individuals trying to make it to the NHL, but at the same time, you have to play a team game and move forward as a squad?
I think it really comes down to understanding that the more you play like for the team, the better the team as a whole is going to be able like to play for you, like fitting for you. So the more effort you put into playing like with the game plan that the team has, it's going to be able to become an easier environment to play better in. And I think the more people that buy into that, makes it just like an environment where people and like the players look better, and then it's like easier to kind of get that exposure too. So it really just comes from buying into the team and the way the team wants to play.
So from your perspective, you're focused on this weekend and the Frozen Four and your pro career. That'll you'll worry about that later.
Yes, correct.
Cross that bridge as it comes along, which, you know, it makes sense, right? You've developed incredibly well, and you put yourself in a great spot to get to that point. As far as, you know, this weekend and the Frozen Four, I mean, you guys fell a little bit short last year. Is there learning lessons in that? How do you go about it this weekend? How does your mentality focus on getting it done this time around?
I don't remember too much from the game last year. I think we started off well, but I think we kind of dipped a little bit. And as I said earlier, as I mentioned, I think the secret to being able to win these big games is staying consistent over the whole course of the game. And it's something that's very hard because, you know, we'll have the power breaks, there'll be the intermissions, and you'll have time where you don't play, you're a little bit, get a little bit off away from it. But I think the better a team is at being able to keep that pressure for 60 minutes, it's going to be a lot easier to win those big games. And that's something I feel like we also stress a lot and have a lot of focus on here. And I really hope we can do that, because when we are playing good and we are dialed in, I think we play really good hockey.
I know you're focused on the Frozen Four, and I know Canucks fans and the organization are excited for you. They're all rooting for you to have success, and at the same time, they're excited to see you in Vancouver one day. What does it feel like knowing that you have this Canadian fan base that's so eager to see you in Vancouver in the future?
I think it's fun. You know, obviously, I want to live up to those expectations, but you know, at the same time, I see it as a big opportunity here too, to kind of play, you know, these type of big games. And I think, you know, as much as that is important, I think this is important too. And just kind of getting that exposure and playing one of these big games, it's going to put me in a better spot to when I make that transition. So I think all the focus kind of has to go towards these games, you know.
How has your coach helped you come along? I mean, he played almost 1,000 games. I think he was close to 900. Jay Pandolfo in the NHL. He was a veteran of Boston University himself, and the Frozen Four. He went, I think, every time of every year of his college career. How has he been a guide for you and the team here during this process?
I think our coaching staff as a whole understand these types of games. You know, what it means to be a team that plays in a way that win championships, and it's very obvious in the way we, you know, talk about the game when we get into these types of games, because it definitely is a little bit different, you know, to comparing it to the normal season games. It is a different type of hockey, and I feel like they have done a good job of communicating that to us, so it definitely helps.
What's it been like watching your teammates and buddies from last year, Lane Hutson and Mac and Celebrini, fight it out for the Calder this season?
It's fun. It's fun. Yeah. It's fun to see too that, you know, seeing like kind of how they played and you know how good they were, like here in the college, division, and then kind of moving on gives you a sense, of, you know, what's to come, like kind of see how they're playing. You know, they were struggling a bit at first, but pretty quickly it kind of let loose for them. But also, you know, at the same time that it does kind of, you know, look as if the step is hard, like it's a tough one. It's still, you know, reachable.
Hey, Tom, we really appreciate all the time you've given us here today. All the best in the Frozen Four. Thanks for this.
Thank you.
There is Tom Belander joining us here on Canucks Central, and the top Canucks prospect is going to play tomorrow in the semifinal against Penn State. It's, I guess, a 5:30 start Pacific time for this semifinal. If they win, then they'll play in the final on Saturday, April the 12th. But if they lose, his season will be over, and then he'd be potentially available for the Canucks to sign as early as Friday.
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting to see when they have to put pen to paper, how these discussions that, you know, may be going on now about should they burn the year, should they not burn the year, and what's more valuable, him playing a single game in the NHL or signing for next year and being able to be part of Abby's playoff run on an AHL deal for the rest
of this year. PTO or ATO, and then the entry level kicks in for the start of next season.
Yeah, so I mean, those are things that they have to figure out. And I'm sure they will figure out here. But it was, he's a very mature young man. You can tell, right? And we, you know, Colin Caribou says he's very well-spoken. He's going to have a job in the media one day. And, you know, a lot of people texting in are very impressed by how well he communicates. And that's been the thing that you noticed the first day he was drafted, when we spoke to him after he was drafted a couple years ago, Reach. He was smart about it, though. You know, he didn't want to focus at all about that, because he's focused on, hey, we have a goal here to try to win the Frozen Four. Like, their playoffs are essentially ongoing, and he's not going to sit there and start getting into when he's going to sign and really get delving into that, into those questions, which I think shows some good discipline from him too, and maturity, and perhaps prep from his side to keep it to whatever. But I think he still tried to convey that he's excited about, you know, being a Canuck, and at the same time being very much focused on trying to win the Frozen Four.
Gordy Locke texts and tweets in, and he says, Volander said on winning Frozen Four, it's now or never. I hear you. Tom is signing by Tuesday. You can look at it that way. But yeah, he was very, very much not willing to delve too deep into conversation about what could happen for the future with his pro career, and focused on the Frozen Four this week.
Yeah, and honestly, I didn't want to press him too hard on it either and be like, so tell us, are you signing or not? Like, he's not going to answer it. But it was a good discussion, and about, I think, the improvements he's made that he talked about too, and the benefits of being in college. And this is why college is becoming such a preferred route for a lot of these players, because you have time to practice. You're playing games, but you have that perfect blend of you're playing 40 games or so, maybe 50 games, depending on how far your team goes.
You have time to build your skill set.
Yeah, and you get to work out, get stronger. And it's so hard for you to be able to maintain strength when you're playing a 70, 80 game season, because you know, you don't have that time to practice.
You're just
as much
working to maintain strength. You're not you're not building muscle you're not building yourself as a person at that age.
Yeah, and by all accounts, he's made the most out of that. And I'm really excited to see what he does.
This hour of Canuck Central is brought to you by BC Liquor. Until April 26th, save $3 on Molson Canadian 24-packs or savor the classic flavor of 40 Creek Barrel Select Whiskey with $2 off. Visit your nearest BC Liquor today. Enjoy responsibly. Coming up next, overrated, underrated, to close out the program on Canuck Central.